Warning, the 619 Crimes podcast contains topics like violence, drug use, and suicide. Please consider this while listening today. Thank you.
Betty Broderick.
22-year-old John Ernest.
34-year-old Sean Nelson.
Kara Knott.
16-year-old Brenda Spencer.
29-year-old Ali Nasser Abulaban.
This is 619 Crimes Podcast, where every Wednesday we bring you short crime stories that took place in San Diego. I am your host, Al Rodriguez. What's up, everyone? We have official merch for the show. Every purchase will help us bring you better shows. I really want to keep improving, and I need to take more time to make the show. So the more purchases you guys make, the more time I'll be able to invest on the show. So if you would like to support, visit 619crimes.store and get your merch. Thank you so much. What's up, everyone? Today's case took place in 1980. 1980 was a very important year for the city. That was the year that the trolley was opened to the public for the first time. Michael Jackson's Rock With You was one of the most played songs that year in San Diego. That's the San Diego we have to look back at for this case. Let's get to it. Michelle Wyatt was the kind of girl who every woman wanted to be like, and every man wanted to date her. Michelle had a huge personality. Everyone loved her. She was a 20-year-old student at Grossmont College. She lived in Santee, California. She was a very active person. She was well known for scuba diving, and she always went on regular hikes. On October 8th, 1980, Michelle made plans to hang out with her boyfriend, Patrick, who she worked with at the local Safeway grocery store. Michelle was so in love with Patrick that she even told her mom that she thought Patrick was the one. At around 9 p.m., the couple went back to her condo and watched TV together on her couch. Patrick had an early shift the next morning, so he went home around 12:45. The next day, Michelle's roommate, Rita, got home, and when she walked into their condo, she instantly saw Michelle's lifeless body on the ground. Michelle had a telephone cord wrapped around her neck, and part of a towel was on her too. Her purse had been dumped all on her living room floor, and the actual purse had been placed inside the toilet. Detectives right away realized that it wasn't a planned attack, because the killer used the things that were available to him in the condo. The media picked up the story right away. It was on every local news channel that evening. Michelle's autopsy was performed, and it revealed that she had been hit on the left side of her head. She had been strangled and raped. She also had a swollen left eye. The medical examiner estimated that she had been murdered around 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock a.m. on October 9th, 1980. So that means it was shortly after her boyfriend went home. The detectives from the San Diego Sheriff's Department right away started to knock on doors at the condominium complex. Two different neighbors heard Michelle's dog barking in the middle of the night, and they also heard some yelling coming from her condo. But neither of the neighbors called the cops. There was another neighbor who actually lived across the street from Michelle. His name was Teddy. He told the detectives that he had seen Michelle's boyfriend's car outside of the condo that night, and that when he went to bed, it was still there. None of the other neighbors ever saw Michelle's boyfriend actually leaving. The detectives did question the boyfriend, Patrick, right away. His reaction was so genuine that the detectives were able to rule him out immediately. They didn't believe that he had a motive to do it. The detectives then started to talk to friends and family of Michelle. Some of her friends told detectives that there was a coworker of Michelle at the Safeway that gave her the creeps. The detectives brought the guy in for questioning. He actually admitted to them that he would drive by her house sometimes just to see if Michelle was there, but that he had never actually stopped by. When they asked for his whereabouts on October 9th, he first told detectives that he had been at home all day with his dad. But the longer he was talking, the more he was switching his story. He then told a different story. He told them he was never actually home that day and that he had went on a date with a girl. Because Teddy kept switching his stories, the detectives thought they had their guy, but they couldn't connect him to the murder. So eventually they excluded him from being a suspect. Michelle had a lot of guys that were trying to date her at the time. So detectives talked to all of them, but they didn't find anything suspicious. With no leads, the detectives weren't making much progress. So Michelle's mother, Lois, was very frustrated. So she printed out hundreds of signs that read, "Who killed my daughter?" with Michelle's picture on it. And you could see them all over the streets of Santee, El Cajon, Lakeside, and La Mesa. Months started to go by, and less detectives were working on the case. And the case went cold for years. But in 1996, the case was reopened. Detectives took the DNA that they had collected through her rape kit and sent it to get tested. They entered the DNA into CODIS. It's a national database for convicted felons. They didn't get a match. It meant that the killer had never been arrested before. The case went cold for another 4 years after that. But in the year 2000, they did more tests on the DNA, and they were able to determine that there were two male profiles in her rape kit. One of the DNAs belonged to Patrick, her boyfriend. And since there was a whole other unknown man's semen in that rape kit, Patrick was able to be ruled out. They still couldn't identify the other DNA profile, though. The sheriff's department then assigned the case to Detective Brian Patterson, who was actually from Santee himself. So he grew up hearing about Michelle Wyatt's murder. Brian sent the DNA sample to a company called Gene by Gene. They gave him back a snip to be able to use on GenMatch to look up possible people. They started to build a family tree from this DNA, and they found three brothers that had matched the DNA. One of them was named Rusty Howard. His DNA was really close to the sample they had. So the detectives believed that he was the father of the killer. When they talked to a cousin of Rusty, though, she told detectives that Rusty had no children. But then, detectives hit gold when they talked to a family member of Rusty, and he told them that he didn't believe that his cousin's dad was actually his cousin's real dad. Rusty had worked on a movie set as a carpenter in Arizona in the 1970s, and he met a woman there named Betty White. They had a short fling, and Betty had Rusty's son, but never told them. His name was John Patrick Hogan. Detectives started to dig into John's past. They discovered that when John was 15 years old, he moved into the same condominium complex as Michelle. At the time of Michelle's murder, John was in the Air Force and was stationed in New Mexico in 1980. So detectives thought they had hit another dead end in the investigation, until they looked into his service records. And John was actually on leave the week that Michelle was killed. Now all that was left to do was track John down. But unfortunately, detectives found out that he was dead. John died on the 24-year anniversary of Michelle's death on October 9th, 2004. He died of a meth overdose. When John died, his family cremated his body, so detectives didn't think they had any way to 100% connect him to the death of Michelle. But when they reached out to the medical examiner who had done the autopsy on John in Phoenix, they actually still had John's blood card. When the San Diego detectives sent that in for testing with the DNA that they had gotten from Michelle's rape kit, it was a 100% match. Michelle's family was then able to get some closure. But since they were never able to question John Hogan, Michelle's parents were never able to really know what exactly happened to their daughter. John was 18 years old when he murdered Michelle, and he died at the age of 42. Again, exactly 24 years to the day of the murder of Michelle Wyatt. What's up, everyone? We have official merch for the show. Every purchase will help us bring you better shows. I really want to keep improving, and I need to take more time to make the show. So the more purchases you guys make, the more time I'll be able to invest on the show. So if you would like to support, visit 619crimes.store and get your merch. Thank you so much. Hope you enjoyed today's episode. The music for the show is created by Salvador Morales and hosted by me, Al Rodriguez. Please leave us a review on whatever platform you use so we can get the show in front of more people. We also ask that you click the share button and share with a friend. It would really help us. You can follow us on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at 619 Crimes Pod. This has been the 619 Crimes Podcast. See you guys next Wednesday. Peace.